Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This hour on The Brian Lehrer Show, former Vice President Al Gore starts us off, and we'll get to him right after this brief reminder that we are in our winter membership drive of 2013, and I hope you'll donate something to help us run the radio station. You can do it anytime at WNYC.org or call 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692. Thank you so much for considering it. He used to be the next president of the United States, settled for an Oscar, an Emmy, and a Nobel Peace Prize, was even funny on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me last weekend.
We all remember 2000 and the somewhat disappointing result for you.
Somewhat disappointing.
And not content to think small thoughts, his new book tackles the biggest issues facing humanity in the next generation, literally. It's called The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. Vice President Gore, it's an honor. Welcome to The Brian Lehrer Show.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I can't resist but to start with the news today out of China. The world's fastest growing climate polluter announced that they will impose something that you call for in your book, a carbon tax. Did you hear about that yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's very welcome. It remains to be seen how significant their CO2 tax will be. But they have been moving for some time in this direction, and the new leader coming in next month, Xi Jinping, has been an advocate of doing more to fight the climate crisis. They've already put in place a cap-and-trade system in two cities and five provinces, and they've announced that's a pilot program for a nationwide cap-and-trade program in 2 years. So this CO2 tax is in addition to that. And, you know, you have to wait. We'll have to wait and see how significant it is. It's a good news, bad news story overall there, but this is an optimistic sign.
Is there a number that you would be aiming for? I heard that it's going to be about $2 a ton at first, rising to about $20 a ton by 2020. Are those meaningful numbers, in your opinion, to make a difference in carbon load?
Well, they can be directional. They can set the direction. They can send a signal, because most of such proposals start small and then they escalate over time to give industry and the economy a chance to adjust to the decarbonization imperative. But by themselves, you know, the small numbers being talked about in the initial tranche would simply set a direction. By themselves, they would not solve the crisis.
One of the six drivers of global change in your book is the shift in the balance of power, primarily from political systems to market systems, from public to private entities, among other things, with loose campaign finance laws giving polluters too much control over our democracy. But China has no democracy. It has authoritarian technocrats, and they take this step and some cap and trade, as you mentioned. And I hate to think that less democracy is ever better than more democracy, but how much should it scramble our thinking about what makes good governance?
Well, I hear that argument from time to time, Brian, and I don't agree with it. There's no doubt that authoritarian governments can make swift moves without public opposition, but over time, it's simply not stable. They have extremely high levels of corruption. They cannot go for much longer without considerably more latitude for free speech, because you just can't have the a central government insulated from the experience of the people.
Right.
And the people have to be able to express their desire for the changes that that people want. So, yeah, they can have a temporary advantage with authoritarianism, but in the long run, we really represent the future of governance in the world, but we have to repair our own democracy and our markets. Our democracy has been hacked, as I write in this book, and I don't know that we have time to go into all of the details about it, but in essence, big money has way too much control of decision-making. No significant reform can be enacted in our Congress unless they first get permission from whatever special interest is most affected by the proposed reform. So they take out the public option, and they won't let in health care, and they will not allow the government to bargain with the pharmaceutical companies for reasonable prices in the Medicare and Medicaid program. And those are just examples mm-hmm. that illustrate what's happening across the board. The special interests are in control.
And in the book, you call on people to, quote, restore the usefulness of capitalism as a tool for reclaiming control of our destiny.
Yeah, our markets have been hacked in the sense that short-term decision-making now works against the best interests of companies, shareholders, markets. You know, these quarterly earnings projections, Trump long-term value creation, 60% of the trades on the New York Exchange and the London Exchange are now high-speed, high-frequency trades made by supercomputers in milliseconds. The flow of these derivative instruments around the world just completely dwarfs the volume and value of real transactions representing the sale and purchase of real goods and services or commodities. And we get more frequent disruptions. And the subprime mortgage fiasco triggered a global run on the banks, the credit crisis, and in turn the Great Recession, from which we're still trying to achieve escape velocity. And so regulations and laws written to please the special interests put the rest of the economy at risk.
Al Gore, my guest on WNYC, his new book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. And we have this rampant inequality through the big trends that you write about in the book. Robots doing work that people used to do, whether it's in factories or what you just mentioned, on Wall Street, making, you know, mega instant trades. We have capitalism without borders, chasing the lowest wage, corporations in control of our politics. I remember the televised debate that you were in as vice president against Ross Perot on NAFTA and free trade. And there he was, the big-time industrialist, arguing for protectionism to keep wages from being sucked down to the lowest common denominator. And there you were, the progressive Democrats, supporting, in a way, the go-go capitalism of open borders for money. Should I take your book as indicating that you've rethought your position on that?
No, not at all. You know, Mexico, in the economic realm, has been a success story. Their economy is coming up. Net immigration flows are now zero, as you may know. They have a great climate policy. They're slowly getting this horrendous drug violence and drug warfare under better control. They have a big fight ahead of them. But no, this was the right thing to do. And reciprocal free trade that protects the environment and protects labor is unstoppable and is in our interests. But there's no question that we are now facing some very big disruptive choices. You mentioned robo-sourcing. I'll give you another quick example. Mm-hmm. Some law firms are using a new algorithm that makes it possible for one first-year lawyer to do the same amount of legal research that used to require 500 first-year lawyers, and the number of mistakes goes way down. And according to conventional economic analysis, supported by evidence over the centuries, those other 499 lawyers will find new jobs that are opened up by the new technology. But an increasing number of economists are now expressing concern that the so-called Luddite fallacy may now itself be a fallacy, in the sense that what we are now extending and magnifying with new technology is not only our physical capacities, but our cognitive functions, and a great deal of work that used to be the mainstay for middle-class income flows is now being both outsourced and robo-sourced, and we will soon face the challenge of replacing those income flows if the consumer demand economy is not to slow down and fall into a permanent low-growth pattern.
Let me ask you a question that I asked the environmental activist Bill McKibben earlier in the week, and I'm curious to see if you give the same response. It's about fracking, and I understand that we are actually emitting less carbon, if what I read is correct, today in the United States than we were in 2005. And so we're going in the right direction. And one of the big drivers of that, according to what I've read, is that fracking for natural gas means we're less dependent on coal, especially, and so we're producing less carbon. Are you open to fracking as an anti-global warming tool?
Well, I proposed 20 years ago in my first book, Earth and the Balance, that natural gas could serve as a bridge fuel while we see the scaling and development of renewable sources of energy. But there has been a great deal of evidence collected in the last 20 years, particularly in the last 5 years with the fracking boom. And here's the fly in the ointment, Brian. It's true that natural gas has approximately 50% of the CO2 content that coal has, two-thirds of what oil has, but each molecule of methane, if it is leaked directly into the atmosphere, as is happening now, has 70 times the global warming power of a molecule of CO2. So the math, that's over a 10 to 20 year time span. So you don't have to leak that much methane directly into the atmosphere in order to cancel out the global warming advantages that come from switching from coal to natural gas. And unfortunately, the way this fracking technology is being used, particularly by the smaller wildcat operators, which have the majority of the rigs out there, they're venting a lot of methane directly into the atmosphere, and that really has to stop. We should have a nationwide rule on that. George Phineas Mitchell, the Texas oil man who really innovated this fracking and horizontal drilling technology, has called for such regulation. But the industry opposes it, and again, they have the political power to stop it from happening until and unless enough people say enough already.
And you'll be interested to know that you did give basically the same answer as Bill McKibben, and that is around the word methane. Let me ask you a local question, if I might. We've had a very green mayor in New York the last 12 years. I don't know if you pay any attention to New York or worry that the next mayor may not continue some of Mayor Bloomberg's sustainability efforts because of budget constraints or lack of commitment or whatever. Have you given any thought?
Yes, I have. Everybody in the U.S. and many throughout the world could claim a kind of auxiliary citizenship in New York City. It's kind of the capital of the world. And I think Mike Bloomberg has done a terrific job. And on the environment, I have been an ally to him. I've admired his leadership, and I hope that that whoever turns out to be his successor will also continue the focus on sustainability and environmental protection and climate policies that work. And I think that there's a strong enough political feeling in New York City to make it at least very likely that the next mayor will feel the need politically to continue such policies. I hope so.
We have just 2 minutes left. Let me ask you briefly about Current TV. And you've been asked a million times about Al Jazeera, so I'll ask you something else. Do you think there just isn't an audience in America for two liberal cable channels, MSNBC and your former network, couldn't both make it in the marketplace?
Well, we were profitable every year, and I'm, very proud of what we did. We won most of the major awards in television journalism, but we did not have corporate deep pockets as the only independent news and information network. We could not continue indefinitely in an age of conglomerates. It's a consumer-facing industry, and all of the conglomerate networks are able to get free advertising across the dial on their sister channels, where we had to pay a top dollar for it. But again, I'm proud of what we did. I think that when people get a chance to see Al Jazeera America, which will start up in another month or so, I think they're going to be very impressed with a 24/7 serious network that focuses on news gathering around the world and has bet its future on building its reputation for integrity and excellence. So I'm looking forward to it.
So many people denounce our polarized politics and news media. Were you contributing to it with Current TV by launching a politically identified or ideologically identified network?
Well, I don't think so. We were very different from MSNBC. And remember, we started as an experiment to try to get user-generated content or viewer-contributed content. And it turned out that that was more difficult than we expected. And so we did make a shift. I think we had outstanding programming. Vanguard, our investigative series, was honored with all these awards. And I thought that our commentators were very smart, very tough, and many of them still on the air. I think they do a terrific job, Cenk Uygur and Jennifer Granholm, John Fugelsang. I think they do a terrific job.
And I'm going to let you have a last word on anything you want, maybe from the themes of your book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. But I had your editor, John Meacham, on last hour to talk about other things, and I mentioned on the air to him that I think it's so admirable that rather than sit back and write a self-serving memoir, as many former politicians do, that you have tried to write what I might call the great American nonfiction book, which whether people agree with your conclusions or not, you try to encompass literally all the biggest challenges facing humankind for the next century. So congratulations on the effort.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate it. And this book, I feel passionately about this book, and I hope people will enjoy it. It's not as big as it looks. The last 150 pages are footnotes, and I've really poured my heart and soul into it, and I hope that people who read it enjoy it, and I hope even more that people will read it with their minds and hearts open to the challenge to become an active participant as a citizen of this country in reclaiming our democracy and ensuring that we participate in shaping the future.
Al Gore, by the way, will be appearing at the Powerhouse Arena on March 8th at 6 p.m. That's a ticketed event, and the store is at 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. Powerhouse Arena, Al Gore on March 8th at 6. Vice President Gore, thank you so much for giving us a few minutes.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay tuned.